Ho, ho, ho. Oops, didn't mean to offend. Welcome to Too Wretched for Radio, sitting in the Grace to You studio for our Christmas extravaganza. Go ahead, Phil, ring the bells.
I don't have any bells with me, but...
Wow, apparently you didn't get the memo that we were doing a Christmas program.
I'll sing Jingle Bells if you want.
Uh-huh, I want.
Now forget it.
Wait a second. You just can't throw that out. You were in the Moody Choir.
Yeah.
Come on, just a little.
I was back in the
just
day.
Just a little Tony Bennett Jingle Bells.
Not going to do it. I did leave some chestnuts roasting on an open fire in the other room for
you. Is that what I smell? Yeah. All righty, I'm in the Grace to You studios with Phil Johnson. Santa Claus, Christmas. Phil, let's talk about if the Christian should indeed be participating in anything Christmas, because you've got the Santa Claus issue. And look, yeah. I don't like Santa Claus either. I just don't think it has any place in Christian worship, a Christian home. But does that mean that we should not be celebrating anything Christmas?
No, I don't think it means that. I mean, this is classic Romans 14 stuff. You know, you can either celebrate a day or not, and don't bind another person's conscience by your view of holidays. I mean, that's one of the things that Paul specifically names in Romans 14, and I think this generates a lot more heat and polemical angst than it really needs to.
Do you think that the Christmas celebration has any roots connection at all to paganism?
Not that I know of, and even if certain symbols or words or whatever are deep in the centuries past connected somehow to Saturnalia or whatever it is people say, that's not a thought in my mind. And I do try to approach Christmas in the sense of wanting to focus my mind and attention on the biblical aspects of the story, you know. But I'm not going to condemn somebody because they put a Santa Claus in their window, you know.
I jumped in when I shouldn't have.
Yeah, I've never been a fan of Santa. I'll tell you my own experience. When I was about, I don't know, 7 years old or something, too old to be naive about it, I remember this vividly. My mom used to cut my hair. I was sitting on the kitchen stool getting my hair cut by her, and I always tried to be really good when I was getting a haircut because if I did anything naughty, she'd thump me with the scissors, you know, on the head, and that hurt. And but it occurred to me there can't be any such thing as Santa Claus. And I said, is there really a Santa Claus? Because that doesn't seem real. And she said, no, you're right. There's no Santa Claus. And I'm thinking about it. And what about the Tooth Fairy? There's no such thing as that either. And there's no Easter Bunny. All those things are phony. And she's like, yeah, you finally grew up, you know? And so I thought about it a little more, and I said, well, what about Jesus?
Right.
And she thumped me with the scissors.
As well she should.
Yeah, that's right.
All right.
And the only thing that really saved me from, you know, becoming an atheist at age seven, when I realized they've been lying to me about all this stuff, was the realization that, look, all right, we go to church every Sunday to study the Bible and talk about Jesus. He is in a different category from all these, you know, fantasy figures. But I made it a purpose when we had kids, Darlene and I agreed, we're not going to try to deceive them into thinking that Santa Claus is real.
All right, two things. Number one, I like your mom.
I loved her too.
Yeah, okay, can I do my impression of your mom cutting your hair?
Yeah.
It's so thick, dear. Got the thickest hair on the planet. A weed whacker must bog down on your head.
I inherited that from her. She never went gray either. So,
and there you are. You got a couple sprouting. You got a couple of rogue gray hairs, but otherwise. All right. Second, you would say that somebody who puts a Santa Claus, they're a Christian, they go to church with you, they put a Santa Claus thing in their window, doesn't bother you. Look, I totally think it's a bad idea to teach Santa Claus, and I would disagree with that decision. I think exactly your experience is one of the dangers in this, that you – what about these other issues lying to me about?
When my youngest son was about 6 years old and we're walking through the mall, and of course there's Santa everywhere, and he points to him and he goes, hey, look, Mom, It's the Christmas man. He didn't even know his name.
Oh, that's funny.
So, yeah.
The Christmas man.
The Christmas man.
I think it's also bad theology because it teaches our kids you get rewarded if you're naughty or nice. So it,
yeah,
it feels
that's right.
far more Roman Catholic.
That, to me, is worse than some of the other stuff, that aspect of it. That,
all right.
You know.
Now, so I think it's a bad idea, but a fellow believer, they're into Santa Claus. I have seen Christians go to the mattresses over this and divide. Is this an issue worthy of division?
I wouldn't argue with anybody about it. I would just say, look, this is what we did in our family. It worked out great. Our kids all love Christ, and none of them ever had to believe in Santa. And I don't think any of them would ever say or think that we took any of the magic of Christmas away from them. But what we did was focus on the real message of Christmas. You know, I understand... I'm tolerable of Christians who, you know, Santa Claus is actually rooted in a real person, St. Nicholas, who was quite an interesting and good fellow, who supposedly punched a heretic in the face. And it's hard not to like a guy who punches heretics in the face, right?
Well, not exactly the way it should be handled, but you appreciate his passion.
Right, yeah.
All right, but this kind of brings us into the issue of Christian liberty. Because let's just say, I'll just play the role of somebody who feels really passionate about this. They just think one of their kids, they taught them about Santa Claus, and the kid became apostate because they did.
Yeah.
Their mom didn't hit him in the head with the scissors when they started questioning if you're being honest with me on other issues. So let's just say I feel very deeply about it, and it's like, no, Phil, you should feel the other way about it. And it always is difficult to put it under the category of Christian liberty when I have such a strong conviction about it. So how do I figure out what is indeed a conviction issue, a conscience issue, when I should divide over it or not?
I think the question is, it goes back again to what we've said so many times, is this really a threat to the gospel? Does it entail a denial of any gospel truth? At some points, you might argue, yeah. I mean, if you think being good is, being naughty or nice is the difference of whether you get rewarded or condemned, then that does cloud the issue of grace. But, you know, Christians who talk about Santa, they're not denying the gospel. They, you know.
And it might just be an issue of maturity.
Yeah.
They haven't thought through the issue yet. They haven't come to the, even if they had, they just didn't come to the same
conviction.
I mean,
at some point, Todd, you know this. So you get to the point where there are so many disagreements we might have with fellow Christians. You really have to sort of categorize what is essential and what's peripheral. And the question of whether you tell your kids Santa is real or not is, it's just not one of those issues.
Celebrating Christmas, even though people, I think it's the Christmas tree, you know, it was a pagan, part of the pagan celebration with
the
tree.
That's one story. The other story is that Martin Luther was,
that's right.
You know.
Yeah, going back and figuring out historically some of those issues, that's very difficult to do. So while there may be some truth, maybe it was Saturnalia. And it was a part of a witchcraft, sorcery, divination. You got to hold on to that a little bit loosely because history is elusive.
It is, and you know, I don't. To me, if you had remnants of pagan worship, where you're actually, you know, making the Christmas tree an idol or an object of worship, then yeah, maybe you ought to mortify that.
Yeah, you might want to think about burning that tree. All right.
But I don't, you know, it's a decoration. I don't think you could, you're going to live a pretty drab life if you say every single decoration that is related to any holiday is tantamount to idolatry. If you want to live that way, I'm okay. I'm not going to criticize you, but.
Would Halloween fall underneath the same?
Yeah, I mean,
category.
One thing that worries me is Halloween in my neighborhood has become a bigger deal than Christmas. My neighbors,
what is it? I agree with you.
My neighbors decorate their houses more.
And
when I was a kid, nobody did that.
Thing. No. I know. And it's all the ghouly stuff.
Yeah, on both sides of me this year, my neighbors made their front yards into graveyards. I was like I was living in between a graveyard.
Well, I know exactly what you need to do. Put up a big statue of Martin Luther in your front lawn. That's what you need to do.
You know, that's a good idea. Maybe we'll do that
next
year.
I'm just trying to help. All right. Another subject regarding Christmas, and that is Christmas in the culture. all the secular songs. I think we can still listen to them and enjoy some of them, you know, based on taste and preference and some of the issues like Santa Claus. But there are some Christians who would say that a clerk at Target or wherever must say Merry Christmas.
Yeah, I don't see any rule about that. That's like, that's very similar to the school prayer issue, which, you know.
Oh, are you going to get in trouble for this?
Yeah, I know. But when I was a kid, they did actually, I'm old enough to have gone to school when we had to recite a prayer. And of course, they took that out of school. I don't like the atheistic motives that was behind that change. But on the other hand, I'm happy that someone appointed by the U.S. government isn't teaching my kids to pray. And the same thing is true with the clerks at Walmart. I don't expect them to, you know, respond to me with any kind of religious jargon, you know, whether they say the Lord bless you or Merry Christmas or any of that stuff is immaterial to me. They can be Muslims as far as I'm concerned. It's my job to be a testimony to them, not their job to be a testimony to me. So for Christians to be upset because some clerk doesn't say Merry Christmas seems to me to be a kind of backward thing. Say Merry Christmas to them. You're free to do that. And you know, if they're not saying Merry Christmas to you, it doesn't necessarily mean anything other than that, you know, they're not Christians.
So
probably they're not Christians.
You hate America.
I don't hate America. I just don't think the proper way to
I get why people are, they have angst over it. It's like, ugh, we used to be in a country where even Jewish people would say Merry Christmas.
But it is just like the school prayer issue. It's one thing to be disturbed by the motive that has driven that from our culture. I am too. But to make the symbol itself the issue isn't, that's not good. The responsibility falls on us as Christians to be a testimony to these people in our society who are not Christians, never heard the gospel, don't believe the gospel. Why would you expect them to say, you know, any kind of religious jargon, much less Merry Christmas, which really isn't?
Well, I feel the pain of those people. But to me, when we make somebody say something Christian, okay, Merry Christmas, it's got the word Christ in it, it's the Christ Mass, and some people get upset about the Roman Catholic idea behind that. But forcing somebody to say something Christian is the opposite of the Christian faith.
Yeah, yeah.
That's Pharisaism.
Yeah, to me, the deadly things about Christmas are the things that people think are innocent and innocuous, you know, Hallmark movies that endlessly talk about Christmas magic and Christmas stuff.
You've seen some, have you?
Oh, yeah. Sadly, I've seen.
There's two Hallmark channels now. Did you know that? Two Hallmark channels.
I think I did know that, yeah.
And it's like this Christmas, you know, 9 days of Christmas, yep. Two channels blasting. And this is interesting. I just watched one last night because, well, I've got free time. And so I was watching it. And Phil, you're not going to believe what happened. There was a pretty girl and a handsome boy. And at first they didn't get along. But when she discovered that he had a bad childhood, she understood him better and was able to look past his country music celebrity fame. And in the end, they kissed.
Yeah, but you see, you shortened the story because I know these plots, and there was also something in there that kept them from getting together when it was obvious to everybody watching that these two people belonged together.
Right. And you never feel the chemistry anyway, but it's like, okay, I know where this thing is.
It irritates me. You know, I won't mention the family member who watches those. But
Darlene.
Now you got me in real trouble.
but you know what, though? It's kind of, it's almost a shtick in a lot of homes.
Yeah.
Where the women tend to like watching those. And I actually get their appeal in that, you know, they're safe.
Yeah, make you feel good.
And it's just, it's wholesome, right. And there's no swearing going on. And there's typically one kiss. Although there was a Hallmark movie, 9 times they kissed before they came together in the end. 9 times.
They're pushing the limits.
I'm just saying that Hallmark, just don't be surprised when they're X-rated.
What kills me is they it's the same three or four plots endlessly recycled. It's the same story every time. I can watch, you know, the first 5 minutes and tell you who's going to end up with whom and what the, and it irritates Darlene. I'm like, I can tell you how this is going to end. Can we turn it and watch
Shush, I know this. How'd I do with my Darlene impression? Yeah,
not too bad.
All right.
But so, but back to the Christmas issue. What's like you said, those are innocent. They're fine. There's nothing sinful about watching them and all of that. But what they do in effect is rob the idea of Christ or anything that's Christ-centered from Christian or Christmas. The only thing you'll actually get that's Christian in those movies is occasionally they'll sing a hymn that's related to Christmas.
Right.
And because it's a hymn, and it's so familiar, it's a Christmas song.
Or Candace Cameron Bure is in it, and then it's Christian.
Yeah.
So that pretty much qualifies it. All righty. So mandating that people say, don't be offended when the clerk doesn't say Merry Christmas. The corporation has decided they aren't going to have their people say it. To boycott them and to threaten them, first of all, not wise. It's not necessary. And I think it's counterintuitive to the gospel itself.
Right. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, in fact, if you go to Walmart near my house, you're likely to check out in a lane with a woman who's wearing a Islamic head covering, you know?
Right.
I wouldn't expect her to say, you know, bless you in Jesus' name or anything like that. Merry Christmas, even.
Right.
I don't say Happy Ramadan to her.
Well, and not only that, but I do notice that the same Christians who are upset that people don't say Merry Christmas never think or bat an eye about Easter. And that, to me, is the more significant holiday.
Yeah, we haven't even touched on that.
Which, that Easter?
Yeah.
Well, it's the same. I figured we could apply the principle from Christmas because the same thing is true. The paganism that people believe about Easter.
Yeah.
Well, look, here's East. We're celebrating the resurrection of Jesus Christ, an historical fact. Now, what pagans did on that day or not, I don't care, because that is Christmas. I get that because we don't have the date. We don't see that. That's, you know, kind of a pinnacle. It's an important story, certainly. But Easter is the big, and I don't care. We know when Jesus was crucified, when he rose from the dead. Let's celebrate it. But people don't seem to care if somebody says Happy Easter or not.
Yeah.
All right.
Good point.
All right. Another Christmas subject, sort of. New Year's. Resolutions. I'm going to ask you, Phil Johnson, as we enter into 2019... Oh, that really just, my sciatica. I remember when we were partying like it's 1999, and now we're in the 2019 business. What would be, you're not a prophet. Am I correct about that?
Yes, that is correct.
You do not receive words from the Lord. Am I correct about that?
That is correct.
All right. What would your predictions be about 2019 regarding the church?
Oh, well, I think large segments of the evangelical movement are going to get worse and drift further into issues like social justice and, pragmatism.
Pragmatism cannot be overstated.
No, it's a huge issue. And you see it even in the supposedly young, restless, and reformed. And so this, I think, would be probably my dominant prediction about where the evangelical movement is headed. I think you're going to see a sudden and marked move away from the reformed part of young radical and reformed.
I think that's, for the most part, already happened.
Yeah, no question about it.
And the whole idea...
But there are still those who at least verbally claim to be reformed and somewhat Calvinistic, right, and all that. But I think you're going to see a backlash against that, where it's not going to be popular anymore at all to refer to yourself as reformed.
All right. I have in my hand, speaking of the social justice issue, this is announcements at Bethel in St. Paul. These are Bethel announcements. Bethel University is what they're now called. It has historically been considered an evangelical, pretty much mainstream. But, Phil, 15 years ago, I went over to Bethel. I remember it vividly. I was doing radio, and I was just grabbing kids on the Bethel campus and asking them what the gospel is. Absolutely clueless. So I'm witnessing to the kids at the Bethel school. It was Bethel College back then. And I remember sitting rather, dejected on a bench thinking, well, know, maybe that question's too hard for a 20-year-old who's going to university to study, you know, chemistry or sociology.
Yeah, in an evangelical school.
At an evangelical school. So some kid comes walking by, and I went, hey, dude, come here and sit down with me. Got a question for you. What's the gospel? And he said, well, in order to understand the good news of the gospel, we really need to go back to the garden. You see, in Genesis 3, and he just lays the whole thing out. And it's like, okay, this is not too hard. The kids can, when you're 20, you can understand the gospel. One kid out of the whole lot at Bethel knew what the gospel was. So I think that they have been drifting for a very long time.
Yeah.
At Bethel.
Decades. And it's not just Bethel. It's mainstream most. Evangelicalism. Yeah. When, you know, going back to whenever it became the notion of the typical evangelical was that the model church is Willow Creek in Chicago or Saddleback in Southern California. And pragmatism became ensconced as the liturgy of evangelicalism. Pragmatism.
No.
We entertain people. We draw crowds.
But, I think actually it was last Thursday, I can't remember, you know, with barely escaping the fire, it's hard to remember all of the days here in California. But John MacArthur was talking. We were in a small group with him. And he was talking about pragmatism. And for some reason, the nail got driven deeper in my understanding of it. That when we go about the business, now I'm not talking about the Robert Schuller going out and polling, but in a sense, that's kind of what, you know, what's cool, what's the trend, what's the clothing, what's the music that we can, that's pragmatism, and it's culture determining how we do church and not God determining how we do it.
I mean, Todd, my contention has been from the beginning that behind this, the sudden, and every time I say sudden, everybody says, no, this is an old movement. But the sudden push among evangelicals to make social justice the key topic and put that at the forefront of everything we think about and do, that sort of sudden interest in the high level of interest that came on very suddenly on social justice, that is driven by pragmatism as well. It's simply a reflection of what the culture's talking about. But it's a sanitized version. When the culture today talks about social justice, it's not primarily, or at least not exclusively, about racism. They would include LGBT rights and all of that. And the problem with the evangelical movement is that they have accommodated culture for so long that it's merely a matter of time before even within the, in fact, you see hints of it already within the evangelical movement, there's going to be pressure for us to regard LGBT rights as a moral and biblical issue that we need to concede on. Our culture has been correct on this, and it's the biblicists who are wrong.
And we got to get with the program.
Yeah.
Well, to your point, sir, from Bethel.edu, White Christian Imagination and Shame is this newsletter that was sent to me. Does the practice of white imagination and the unchecked embodiment of shame hinder reconciliation? Pastor D, D-E-E, maybe it's a dude named D, we'll give the benefit of the doubt, church planter and senior pastor of Lighthouse Church in Minneapolis, will present a talk on white Christian imagination, how whiteness has disembodied the biblical narrative. That's pretty impressive. Yeah. So we don't know the gospel is
they're,
the accusation.
They're doing that at Bethel?
Yes.
Wow.
Join students enrolled in the new Reconciliation Studies course, European American Experiences, Whiteness and Reconciliation. That's the name of the course. All those words right there. As we explore how the relationship between the practice of white imagination and shame can undermine biblical interpretation and foster disunity in and outside of the church. There it is.
Wow.
Now, that to me smells an awful lot like the world.
Yeah, no question about it. That's exactly what the academic world, secular academic world, has been doing for 20, 30 years. And what you see there is, I think, an academic institution, and they're not by any means alone in this. Lots of Christian universities have gone the same way. They desperately crave a kind of academic credibility that they can only have if they get on the same wavelength as secular universities. And they think they can do it and not compromise the gospel, but eventually they always wind up compromising the gospel.
Look, we have so much to say about racial issues. We have so much to say about people groups who are struggling from a biblical perspective. But what I see coming out of so much of, not everybody, but so much of the social justice movement, it isn't helping anybody.
No, well, in fact, just what you read there about white imagination and white this and white that, that is overtly a sort of racialization of whatever issue it is they're trying to talk about. It's the white people who are the problem. It's simply a different kind of racism. Now, we're blaming a race or an ethnicity or skin color, really, is what, when you use the word white, you're simply talking about skin color. You're blaming people with a certain skin color for whatever problem it is you want to address. And that's,
but that's
more and more
common. It's postmodernism is where that really comes from.
It is. But what's disturbing is to hear it from ostensibly conservative evangelicals,
right,
who are saying,
you know
we're too white.
What this reminds me of, I would imagine, Phil, let's say 60 years ago when postmodernism, the French were starting to make it a little bit more trendy to a degree, or at least they had some pretty powerful writers, Foucault, Derrida, trying to forward postmodernism, I am sure there were Christians who said, don't let this in. This will be very destructive. And other Christians said, oh, quit being so uptight and judgmental. And whoop, look at the slope that we have slipped right down.
Well, I'm one of those who was saying, don't let this in. I was doing lectures on postmodernism back around 1999 here in our Shepherd's Conference.
Right.
And you're right. That was the response I got. Not uniformly, but lots of pushback from people who say,
all right,
well, you just...
So pragmatism, the social justice issue, it's still alive. It's being floated. I don't really see like any radical changes in culture or churches happening because of it. How long do you think the social justice thing is going to go?
At least another 18 months.
You think so?
Yep, I do. I think the... the statement that some of us drafted in Dallas put the brakes on a little bit. At least it has caused some of the people who are touting social justice to be maybe a little more thoughtful, a little more cautious about what they say and how dogmatically they say it and all of that, which is a good thing. But I don't think it's enough to stop the train.
No, it did at least provide a lot of people who are getting confused by it to say, oh, okay, not everybody is talking like that.
Right.
I will say this, though, Phil. At this particular juncture, I do believe it's an imperative that we figure out who's who in all of this.
Yep.
Because you've got shades of social justice going on. And if we don't figure out like where everybody's kind of at on this deal, we're lumping them all together, and we might wreck some relationships.
It will sort itself out. I said from the very start that this is reminiscent to me of the trend we saw with the emerging church in around 2005. And they were talking a lot about social justice as well. And nobody was criticizing the emerging church. Zondervan started a whole arm to publish books promoting it. And Christianity Today did a cover article saying how great this is. And I saw it and thought, this is just old-style liberalism under the guise of evangelicalism trying to creep into the evangelical movement. That's why I started my blog, Pyromaniac, back in 2005. And got lots of pushback and all. But I said at the time, I don't see this movement lasting very long. I think it'll be gone within 10 years. It was gone within 6 or 7 years, actually. And I think the same thing is true with the
social justice
thing, partly because it's, like I said, a pragmatic response to social pressures, cultural pressures, the people wanting to get in step with where our society is at. Which means it's just the latest fad. This is just the latest evangelical fad, and evangelical fads come and go, and this one's going to go as well. The problem is it's going to be replaced by something equally sinister or possibly worse.
Oh, I think we know what issue's coming next.
The homosexual rights thing?
After we deal with women's issues.
Yeah.
I think that has to be first,
yeah,
and then the gay issue will be the next serious threat to evangelical Christianity.
Yeah.
All right. So pragmatism, social justice in 2019. Any other predictions for the year, where you see the church headed? Any good predictions for the church?
Well, because I often sound like I'm just a critic. I don't see anything positive, but that's not the case, actually. I do think there's a remnant that is growing.
I do too.
It's not like the remnant is diminishing. The remnant is growing. The people who see the dangers in the way the greater movement is heading. you know, 5-6 years ago, I don't know of anyone who would have been openly critical of the Gospel Coalition, because this was an organization of ostensibly conservative people, all about the gospel, and that's the way they portrayed themselves. What did I say, 5 years ago? Maybe let's go back 7 years ago, because a couple of years after they were founded, they began to publish things and say things that I thought, where's the gospel in this? You know, they gravitated on their website to more cultural commentaries, weird movie reviews, reviews that you would think no Christian should even think about going to see that. And they have a review about, you know, the gospel themes that you'll find in
right.
it, that sort of thing. And I thought, this is not a good trajectory for this organization. But, you know, my early whispered criticisms of them were not well received by most people. Why would you criticize them? This is a good group, you know. These days, I think a lot of people see the trajectory of the Gospel Coalition as at least, at the very least, iffy, if not dangerous. And so this organization that was founded supposedly to bring people together about the gospel
is dividing right now.
Now they're dividing people over social justice.
They sure are.
Other things.
And it's a shame.
Right. But they are consumed as an organization, it seems like. Not everybody in it, but the drift of the organization seems to be consumed by following these fads.
Well, it was coined by, was it Kevin DeYoung and what was the other fellow? Young, Restless, and Reformed. The fellow who...
Oh, Colin Colin Hanson.
Was it Hanson who coined that with him?
I don't remember.
Well, regardless, Young, Restless, and Reformed. It's like we were all excited, a bunch of young guys. They're bending more conservative. That's good. But the immediate message should have been, okay, everybody, we're young, but we're going to grow up right now.
Yeah, yeah,
and
that's right.
And it didn't happen. Their supposed conservative theology didn't infect anything. And it was the pragmatism that overrode their Reformed theology.
Yep, that's right. However, back to my point, I'm not utterly discouraged by it, because I remember back to when I was first saved in the late 1970s, how hard it was to find any church where the pastor would just open the Bible and preach from it. Things were shallow. Everybody was obsessed with finding prophetic fulfillments in the daily headlines, and you know, Hal Lindsey's book was at the top of the charts, and that year was Expo 72, was it, in
what?
Dallas?
What was that?
It was a Campus Crusade big gathering that was supposed to be like the Christian Woodstock. You know, they saw the success of Woodstock, and so 2 or 3 years later, they wanted to have a big festival like that in Dallas, Expo 72, I think it was called, and a lot of celebrities and stuff came, and it was supposedly about Christ, but it was a weird sort of mixture of good stuff and entertainment, basically, and it all seemed very shallow to me. I wanted to learn the Bible. I wanted to understand, you know, Scripture, and it was hard in those days to find. Nowadays, in fact, I lived in Tulsa, right? That was ahead of the charismatic movement, and the conservative churches were either charismatic or you know, rabidly, militantly fundamentalistic in a way that would make anybody uncomfortable. And then big Southern Baptist churches and all that. But to try to find a church where the gospel was the center of their message and you know, the Scriptures were their authority, it was pretty hard in Tulsa in those days. Now I know like 6 or 7 churches in the Tulsa area
that
I could heartily recommend.
No, I agree with that. In fact, the reason that we were out here initially was the Master's Academy International.
Yeah.
So we spent a couple of days with all of those guys and Skyping with people all over the planet. The growth of what is going on overseas with expository preaching, come on. I mean, the Master's Academy, they're in 16 countries. They've got like 60 or 80 little mini seminaries, if you will,
yeah.
that are affordable. They do say that they charge because they need to be invested in the program. I think that's very wise. But I was watching the impact that that is. Like 2,400 pastors trained through them. 2,400. I remember that picture of Steve Lawson in the Philippines. You know, it's that shot from behind him, and, you know, classic Lawson pose, yeah, where, you know, pointing at everybody. But there are 800-900 pastors,
yep,
that were learning about preaching in the Philippines. So I agree with you that whilst this big face of conservatism is definitely showing some cracks, the base is growing, and I think that's the encouragement for 2019.
Yeah, it's obvious to me that those who chase the fads and think that bigger is always better, you know, we need to have mega churches and all that, that's gonna fade into insignificance, and they'll be like the mainstream denominations are now, but there'll be this remnant of churches that now are mostly small churches, where they're just faithfully preaching the word and reaching people one at a time.
Grow.
And yeah,
organically and correctly,
because the gates of hell aren't going to prevail against
that's
the church,
right? Yeah,
so
that's absolutely right. And you know, postmodernism won't, and the emergent won't, and social justice won't. All right, I just got to, this is very exciting news, Phil. I just received a text. This is the association that ranks Christmas specials. They just heard from this, even though we're pre-recording it, what they just heard is that this has been voted, Too Wretched for Radio is the Christmiest Christmas show that's ever been done.
Well, Merry Christmas to you, Todd.
Take it away, Joey. All right, and Joey, if you would put that, if you don't say Merry Christmas, we will boycott. Right at the end, and that'll take us out instead of the typical ending.